When I was a teenager, and honestly, sometimes still today, I was one of those young people who demanded a great deal of themselves, and yet simultaneously beat themselves up over and over again for never being enough. Isn't it amazing how we can do both those things at once? Enough of what? Enough of this or that or whatever. It didn't really matter so much. Just never really enough. On the one hand, I expected myself to be a great big shiny star. I absolutely demanded it, even. In high school, I expected that I would get the highest grade in the class, at least in the classes I cared about. And in college, I swore that I would get nothing less than straight A's in any class that had anything to do with theology. Of course, that had the pleasant side effect of leaving me completely able to ignore anything pertaining to math or science. Unhelpful, perhaps. It was always overachievement of a very qualified sort in that way. When I really decided to do something, when I put my mind to it, I believed with a certain amount of ferocity that I was supposed to be the best. Not the almost best, not pretty darn good, but the best. Sometimes that worked out for me, and sometimes not so much. But it came with a high price, this expectation for shiny brightness. The price was, and occasionally still is, a crippling sense of self-doubt, as if everyone might finally come to see through me, right down to the very fact that though I might be doing great, underneath it, I was and am winging it. Underneath, I was at least as unsure as anyone else, and underneath, I knew darn well that I had never been as good, as capable, or as fundamentally decent a person as perhaps I ought to be, or even in my head, I thought, as good and capable and decent as everybody else. For most of my formative years, I swung like a pendulum, from believing I could and should do anything and everything, to believing I was quite too small and too weak to do much of anything at all. And so in my adolescent brain, I was to be great or be nothing, be a shining star or a failure. I was either to become a wunderkind of a young professional or an overeducated and rather clumsy waitress as likely to spill your dinner in your lap as remember your order. Those were the options, it seemed. I was in the middle of all of this adolescent swinging from one thing to another, trying to find my way, when I spent a good deal of time in a focused spiritual retreat of sorts, in which the leaders got to know every single person who was participating in the retreat really quite well before ultimately assigning us a single word which was intended to be essentially our spiritual goal for the next several years of our lives. One word that we were supposed to spend years focusing on. One word. I remember that I spent most of the beginning of that retreat freely and openly confessing my faults to one and all. The fact of my smallness, the truth of my sometimes shocking, to me anyway, weaknesses, and my ever-present fear that I was not enough. So I thought, for sure, that my lesson that they were going to give me was going to have something to do with strength, with bucking up, with hard work and self-improvement, since clearly these people could not fail to see how flawed a person I was sure that my lesson would be intended to whip my weak self into shape. I also remember that all of the young women, for we were all young women at this retreat, we all gathered together as if in some age-old rite of passage, ready to receive the single word that would be the focus of our spiritual efforts, the one word encapsulation of the work that lay ahead. We went to stand in front of the leaders, sort of like the students at Hogwarts School for Witchcraft and Wizardry when they go to the sorting hat. We stood up there straight-backed, ready to get what we needed. And as soon as we heard our word, we'd come back to our seats and listen to the litany go on. One young woman approached and was given the word courage. She came back to her seat knowing that her task was to be braver than she had been before. Another went up and received silence. She knew then that there must be truth underneath and between the words she was constantly speaking. Another got reverence and knew that her prayer life had been flagging for some time. And I got up there, steeled myself, and prepared myself to receive diligence or discipline or some such thing. What I got left me shocked and confused. And I've been grappling with the spiritual challenge I received that day ever since, which is probably the whole point. My word was humility. I needed to learn humility, they said. Me. Spent all my time reminding everyone who would listen for a very long period of talking how small and fragile and frail I was, me, who had a habit of crying into my breakfast as I contemplated all the ways I had failed myself, God, and the world at the tender age of 18. Humility. Damn, they had me wrong, I thought. Why couldn't I get a good one like devotion or something like that? Here I was, the proudest self-loather of the lot. And I was supposed to learn to be humble. For the longest time, I didn't get it. In fact, it made me mad. I thought that they felt I needed to learn humility because I was too spunky and I was too proud and vocal as a young woman, and they thought I needed to be more demure. Who were they to tell me to be humble as if I were arrogant in the first place? Did I not tear myself down enough to escape the curse of arrogance? Had I not earned my self-loather's stripes? It took me years to stop being mad about it. In fact, I am pretty sure I was already your minister before I finally started to get it. And even now, I sometimes forget. See, the thing is that even a person who vocally loathes themselves is still obsessed with themselves. Even a person who loudly proclaims their own weaknesses for everyone to hear still thinks they are the center of the universe. Even a card-carrying, straight-ticket voter for the pity party lives in a world in which their own needs, their own hopes, and their own failures are paramount. And true humility does not lie at the polar ends of the great arc of the pendulum upon which I swung for so many years. It doesn't lie at the opposite end of grand expectations down in the murk of shame and doubt, but somewhere in the middle, between the dual temptations of self-obsession that lie on either side. I sure did need to learn humility. I still do. And most of all, I needed to learn the difference between humility and simple, easy self-criticism and unhelpful self-loathing. For me, this has been one of the greater spiritual risks I have been asked to take. To be humble without succumbing to the temptation to belittle oneself, to be small without assuming that you are insignificant, to be flawed without assuming you are irreparably broken, to say it like it is, rather than as you would have it be, or as you may fear it is in the darkest of moments. That's the risk. To give a true and unvarnished assessment of oneself to oneself, and not shy away from it in favor of more dramatic, polarizing, and self-obsessed answers. It is the work of knowing who you are, no more and no less, and the work of living richly within that truth. The risk is great. Stare too much into your own nature and you risk missing the wonder and beauty of everyone and everything else. Come to see your place in the family of things as too small and insignificant to have any meaning, and you run the risk of just ceasing to care. But the rewards are great as well. The reward, I guess, is something like honesty, something like truth, and something like clarity in the face of chaos. I am not, as you all know all too well, the best of the best, not even at things I love. And neither am I a wretched little wannabe hurling my flawed words at the great monolith of my failure in a futile attempt to bring the monster to the ground. Life would be more dramatic if either of those were actually true, and my autobiography would make a much more interesting movie. But it's not true. It's not true. And there is something to be said for truth. What I am, what we are, is something lesser and greater than we might once have imagined, something infinitely less bendable into the parameters of a feature film and infinitely more shaped into the confines of a life well lived. With humility, we might come to see that truth. And with humility, the selfhood we might once have imagined as so grand or so small might be everything we need in this life to achieve some magnificent and very minor miracles. Humility does involve seeing oneself as small, but it also involves seeing that smallness as a part of everything. It's being one note in a cosmic orchestra. And in that way, it is the exact opposite of self-loathing. It is self-awareness of your place in the family of things, and it is an honest assessment in a given moment of how empty and how full you really are. That's why I ultimately chose the reading that we shared first this morning, the one from Lynn Unger, whose opening salvo was this simple and eloquent truth that the universe does not revolve around you. The stars and planets spinning in the ballroom of space dance with one another quite outside of your small life. And yet, Unger goes on to say, after listing all the things we can't hold and can't do, like gravity and water and all of that, she goes on to say that the world comes in at every pore, mixes in your blood before breath releases you into the world again. Did you think the fragile boundary of your skin could build a wall? Of course not. We are thus this tiny thing, but a tiny part of everything. And the song sung by the cosmos is our song, and the hopes hoped by the entirety of humanity are our hopes. And though we may be weak and small and sometimes quite obvious in our shortcomings, we are dancing a dance together. And the universe does not, after all, revolve around either our victories, our defeats, our fears or our courage, but rather our interconnection. A colleague of mine, David Rankin, once said, "I have come to trust those who are witnesses rather than those who are gurus." And I think he's on to something. It is those who understand that they are only a small but essential part of things, a witness to creation, who have the most clear-headed assessments of themselves. Gurus, the wise ones to whom everyone else comes for answers. Frankly, they're always just a little bit shady. Always just a little too sure. And in the end, always at the risk of losing track of their own identity underneath their lack of good old-fashioned humility. So here we are, both small and amazing, dancing a dance of the cosmos while trying simply to get to work on time, worrying about the mortgage and whether we'll have enough job security to pay it this year and the next, while expecting ourselves sometimes to jump into the nearest phone booth and become supermen and superwomen, ready to save ourselves, our families, and the world at the moment's notice. Here we are, trying to slow down the wide swing of things and find a home somewhere in the middle of the pendulum's arc. In some moments, we will be miraculous. We will reach heights we didn't know possible, and in other moments, we will be flawed and frightened, alone and wondering what happens next. In the midst of it all, we are simply ourselves. And our task is not to determine if we are failures or wonder workers, not to judge ourselves or praise ourselves, but to be here, where we are, knowing that we share this humble position with all those we love, trying to make a life out of the in-between places that fill the gap between superwoman and soccer mom. Here we are, and honest self-assessment is not beyond our reach. The work is ours to do, the risk ours to take. May we be truly humble, able to say who we are and how we are without fear or drama or self-obsession, able to love ourselves in the presence of our greatness and our smallness alike, aware always that the world does not revolve around us. I want to end today with an invitation of sorts, or an experiment, I guess, as presented in a reading by the Reverend Victoria Stafford. She says that we are always going about the work of making theological choices. We're always being asked to make an honest self-assessment, and sometimes on a moment's notice, whether we want to admit it or not. And in this reading, she calls to mind the fact that we must humbly proclaim a bit of our self-identities all the time, even when we open our mouths to say. Some of you are familiar with our hymnal, with the fact that a great many hymns that you might have known from more traditional religious experiences have their words changed in our hymnal. And this one is referencing specifically the hymn Amazing Grace, which instead of changing the words, gives you an option about what to say. She says, "So last Sunday, when we were all singing Amazing Grace, and we got to that bizarre moment in the first verse where our Unitarian Universalist hymn book slaps down an asterisk and a choice, what did you do? Which did you sing? Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me, or that saved a soul like me?" It probably depends on how you were feeling that day, how particularly wretched or soulful. I know of no other hymnal in print that virtually stops the singing in mid-measure to poll the congregation and call for a theological debate within the mind and heart of every singer. And right there, quickly, because the pianist is not going to wait for you. You have to stake your claim. Make your mark, testify, all the while wondering if the person singing next to you will take offense if you confess at the top of your voice your own wretchedness and that of our common condition as a fallen, faulty species, or will your neighbor be annoyed or maybe shocked if you stand there warbling on about what a pleasant soul you are? What a nice, well-rounded, fully individuated, sin-free, guilt-free, humanist soul. There you stand, frozen in time, and the music plays on while you hastily cobble a theology. It's a lot to ask of people on a Sunday morning. Indeed it is. And the truth is that we are not one or the other, neither wretched nor purely soulful. We are something in between. But in this moment and in all the moments of our lives, we are asked to make a call to know that it's not binding forever, to know that we lie in the middle, and that on either side of the swinging pendulum lies a self-obsession that we need not succumb to. We are a part of everything, both wretched and soulful, both weak and strong, both superwoman and soccer mom. May it be so.